This is the beginning of Class 8.
Sasi Bhagishushenetasham Viravinshinyandekyampati Sangye Shindu Mithepuvahi
collection of merit. Sunna means merit. Remember, we had a friend at work named Sunna. That's what her name means. Sunna Kitsok. Tsok means collection. And ki means of. So collection of merit. It means basically all the first four perfections that you ever work on are Sunna Kitsok. What are the first four perfections?
Giving, morality, patience, and joyful effort.
Yeah. And effort, yeah. Effort, which means to be glad about doing good things. Okay. And generosity, I prefer giving because you can give protection and things like that, you know. So that's Sunam Kitsal. That's the collection of merit. Basically, those four, those first four perfections, which are what? Giving?
Morality. Patience
doesn't mean, it means not to get angry. We don't have a good word in English. It means the ability not to get angry when the time comes to get angry. Patience is like that, but also you say patience waiting for a bus is not the same thing. Patience means when somebody's yelling in your face and you don't react. That's the third perfection. And fourth is effort, which means to take joy in doing something good. And really, effort can go either way. Effort can swing this way or this way. Effort is like a needed for both of these. So therefore, Yeshi Kitsok is which of the perfections? We used up the first four.
The last two.
We're sharp tonight. As sleepy as I am. Yeshi means wisdom. And Tsok means collection of wisdom. What it means is you keep piling up these two things as you practice. All right? For the Buddha, it was Dunjing Lapdong, Dunjing Dudong, Dunjing Dindong. 75,000 kalpas, then 76,000 kalpas, and then 77,000 kalpas. He finished in those three periods. He finished these two. All right? Took him about... 76,000 kalpas and then 77,000 kalpas. He finished in those three periods. He finished these two, alright? Took him about jillions of years, okay? And that's the two collections. Why are they divided like this? Well, you keep piling up good deeds and you keep piling up knowledge. Basically that. Here you're piling up good deeds in the Sunan Kitsal, the collection of merit. And then here you're piling up knowledge. And they're not contradictory. I mean, there can be a lot of knowledge in here and there's a lot of merit in here. Okay, but generally it's a division.
What about the perfection of meditation?
That's concentration, and it should be called concentration. Because it's,
and where is that?
And that goes with Yeshe Kitsal. Because of that thing we talked about so much, your mind has to be in the form realm for you to see emptiness directly. You need perfect concentration to see emptiness directly. That's why they come together. Yeah.
So knowledge in this sense means the concentration and wisdom?
Yeah,
together.
The last two perfections together, mainly. If you're in a debate ground and you don't say mainly, you're in trouble. Okay. And Tsundru effort can swing either way. Obviously, to take joy in being good is necessary in both talks, in both collections. Okay. So, what does Sunam Kitsal cause? Right? What is its result? You can correlate the two bodies of the Buddha to these two talks. So that the Sunam Kitsal mainly causes the form body. What is the form body? It's the physical body that the Buddha has, either the one that's in his paradise, enjoying himself, or the one that comes to this planet to teach people. Those two. That's all caused by the Sunam Kitsal. Right? That's the special cause of the Sunam Kitsal. His form body. His physical body.
Did you say it was a cause of Sunam
Kitsal? No, Sunam Kitsal causes that. And you pile up good deeds. You're piling them up as you practice. Took the Buddha 221,000 countless 60 zeros on the end of that. Okay, and Yeshe Kitsal, what does that cause? The Dharma body. Okay. The Dharma body is the Buddha. Okay. What does that cause? The Dharma body. Okay. The Dharma body is the Buddha. The Dharma of the body of the Buddha has two parts. One is his emptiness. And then the other is his mind, his knowledge. And that's...
Is there a difference between those two things?
Oh, big difference. Mind is a positive thing, emptiness is a negative thing. Mind is a living thing, emptiness is not a living thing. Stuff like that. You see the Dharmakaya, and you see this. You see the Dharma body and you see the form body just after you perceive emptiness directly. Just after you come out of the Tonglong experience, the first part of the Tonglong experience. When you come down, you see these two things directly. You see Buddhas and you see their real nature, which until then you've never seen. It's very difficult to conceive of their nature. And at that point you do see them. That's why you lose doubt at that point. Yeah. By the way, then you realize that every single painting you ever see takes on a totally different importance for you because you know that there's a real person like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, until now they're just kind of nice paintings. And then after that point, you know it's like a picture of some, it's a photograph of someone who really exists. Mm-hmm. And then they become very important for you.
You said that the Dharma body is emptiness and the mind is knowledge.
Yeah,
but
wisdom.
But isn't the wisdom the emptiness?
Wisdom is the knowledge which understands emptiness.
Oh, and then the other one's the actual.
Yeah, one is an object of the wisdom and one is the wisdom itself.
So the Dharma body has emptiness?
Everything has emptiness. But the emptiness of the Dharma body is a very special emptiness. So it rates a separate kaya.
So how is it different than they...
It says Jnana Dharma Kaya. When it says Jnana Dharma Kaya, when they divide it into wisdom Dharma body, then the Dharma part is the emptiness. And your Buddha nature is the thing that will become that emptiness. And people don't understand that. And we got to study Buddha nature someday. It's a long subject. I'm not going to get into it tonight. Anyway, to put it simply, these are the good deeds that allow you to look like a Buddha later. These are the good deeds that allow you to think like a Buddha later. Alright? Geta Chipa, the concept of losing your most virtue, basic virtue. Okay, Gita Chubha is a nasty, horrible subject. It's not a pleasant subject tonight. Okay? How do you destroy the root of your virtue? You know, what actions can cause you to destroy the most basic virtues you have? And those virtues that get destroyed are these. So the concept of destroying your most basic virtues is very important in Hinayana and very important in Mahayana. It comes in both. And in the Abhidharma, this comes next. In your course of study, this is what would come next. It's the discussion in the Abhidharma, which is the first discussion, of how do you actually wipe out your most basic virtue. You know, what I think that's important to know, right? You know, what bad deeds can you do to wipe out your most basic virtue? Right? Very important concept. And the virtue that you're wiping out, if someone should ask you on a homework, is this one. This is what basic virtue means. It means your whole...
You remember one, Michael?
Yeah, it's your whole piled up virtue that you've been working on so long. All right?
Can you not then lose your understanding of selflessness once you have it?
We'll talk about it. But what they're talking about here, when they talk about the good karma that you've collected, the good karma that you've been piling up, that you hope to be, is going to make you into a Buddha eventually. What are there any special kinds of deeds that can destroy it? Just obliterate it. The sutra says, obliterate, wipe out, destroy, smear. You know, there's this whole long list of the original sutra that explains this. This whole long list. Some bodhisattva was bowing, he was doing prostrations at a stupa. And you know, the story is that if you get down on the ground, then every particle of dust covered by your body, you get that many huge virtues. You know? So he got up and the Buddha said, oh, you've done a lot of virtue, because he did some great virtue. You know? Then he went somewhere and he got angry at another bodhisattva. And he wiped all of it out. He just wiped it clean. You know, and the Buddha said, oh, you just wiped clean all that virtue that you did. You know? All right? And we'll talk about how it is and what it is. So that's the idea of wiping out your most basic virtue. The person, you have to talk about the person who can do it, right? And what can do it.
You're talking about destroying karma here, right?
That's exactly. We're having a karma class.
Which must be the counterpart to purification, for instance.
Oh, we might get to that tonight. But that should be a big concern to you, you know? I mean, it's nice to know all about karma, but if you don't know that you could wipe it all out, you didn't study the whole subject, right? Okay, so lokta. Lokta means wrong... Da means view, lokta means wrong view, but the word lok, and you should understand the word lok, implies a diametric opposite, an opposite. Something exists and you think it doesn't exist. So lokta is focused on something which is true, something which really exists. And lokta thinks what?
It doesn't exist.
Not just that. Lokta says it doesn't exist. I mean, classic lokta, Abhidharma way. He's looking at things that really exist and says those don't exist. What do you think would be very effective lokta to wipe out karma?
To believe there wasn't karma? To believe there wasn't anything?
Yeah, no, well, to believe there's no such thing as the loss of karma. Okay. That's the classic lokta. That's the lokta which wipes out your good karma.
Why would it do that?
Well, as a side, I mean, not the, it's immediate. I mean, it's long story, but anyway, mainly because you wouldn't do any good deeds based on a knowledge of karma.
But you could be doing random good deeds.
You would be doing random good deeds.
So why would they?
Apparently, it has the power to wipe out even the good deeds you've done before. You know, what's the? How does it work? We'll talk about it. There's a long list of ways how it works, why it works, how it works.
Michael, if you don't believe that, like they suck to believing that karma is that, but you still believe that you should be a good human being, that you should behave correctly, does that mean you the wiping it? I mean, because on one hand, intellectually you think it doesn't work, but yet you act in it, you know, it works, but not, you're doing
it
outside of the
I think it will come. If it doesn't come, let me know. I think we're going to talk about when you reconnect your virtue. Okay. Actually, the word means more like disconnect or sever, rather than lose your basic virtue. The word japa means to cut or slice. Okay. And then when you get it back, there is a way to get it back, and that's called reconnecting.
Search.
Yeah. All right. So lokta is looking at what?
Looking at things oppositely.
Things that exist and thinking that they don't exist. That's the classic lokta. And here it's focused on the laws of karma. Or it could be focused on Buddhahood itself. It could say there's no such thing as Buddhahood. Okay, Buddhahood does exist. Lokta says Buddhahood doesn't exist.
This is classic. The very, very classic case in our country among people we know, they practice Buddhism for a while, they try Tibetan Buddhism for a while. It doesn't sit with them, or they lose interest, or something, they want to do something that Tibetan Buddhism says they can't do, or something like that. Or they just, there's something happens, there's something happens in their mind, and then after that they say, oh, that's all just garbage, you know. That's lokta. That's classic getachava. That's a very, very dangerous, and very, you know, it would be possible for any of us, I think. You know, I mean, it's something that we could do at this point. Once you've learned, you're kind of in trouble. You know, once you learn a little Buddhism, then if you reject it, you know, if you just say, oh, that's all. I used to go to those classes, it's all garbage, you know. That's a classic world class. That's really the one that does the game. Yeah.
Why is it bad to have a public school?
We'll talk about it. I'm not, absolutely not saying you shouldn't question it. Absolutely not saying that. The Buddha was adamant about it. He said you must question it. But this has to be a total rejection. Okay? And we'll talk about why. This has to be a total, it's all garbage. You know, it has to be something like that. To work as a geta. If you want to do a good geta chipa, you know, don't just reject part of Buddhism. Don't just reject the parts you can't take right now. Don't just doubt it or anything like that. Reject the whole shmio. Then you've got getachapa. You have to reject it actively. Yes.
Okay.
Question?
Yeah. The scriptures talk about certain specific conditions, circumstances that would add up to, like, you know, classical.
Yeah. That's a good point. I'll give you the second one.
Michael, when you said it must be a total rejection, are you saying it must be a total rejection for it to be considered wrong view?
The lokta which can destroy your geta, the wrong view which can destroy your virtue root, has to be a total rejection. It can't be like a Tao or something like that. It can't be skepticism. It's a rejection. It's to say, this is all bullshit. I don't accept any of it. It has to be like that. I mean, if you have trouble accepting certain parts of Buddhism now, which I know everyone normally does, that's not lokta. And it's very, 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 very important that you store those in a cabinet called, I'm not sure about those yet. And you don't say, I don't accept them. You know, you just, when you talk to your friends and when you even think in your own mind, say, you know, I heard Rinpoche say that, I heard Roach say that, I really can't buy it right now. But I'll put it in that cabinet of things that I'm going to check out someday. I don't reject it. And I don't act on it now. And I don't follow it now. But I don't reject it. I keep it there in that group of stuff that I'm not quite sure about. I want to hear more about it. I'll try to decide later. But don't reject it. Yeah.
For it to be a wrong view, is it enough to just reject the idea of karma without having any alternative to embrace and go towards? Is, you know, it's in a way you have half of the wrong view. You're not thinking of something else to replace it, you know what I mean? You don't have a view that's wrong.
Oh, no, it doesn't have to be like that.
You just say, I reject this.
Yeah. You don't have to have an alternate viewpoint which is contradictory. You just say you don't believe it. You say that I'm sure that doesn't exist. Here's the second way to lose your geta. This one is more presented in the Mahayana scriptures, specifically in the Madhyamika scriptures, in the middle way scriptures, by Shantideva and by Chandrakirti. And I thought you might as well know it. It's not mentioned in the Abhidharma presentation.
Is that Kongtrol?
Kongtrol.
Kongtrol.
Kongtrol means anger. And if you've ever read Shantideva, you know what he's talking about. The structure of the Madhyamika scriptures, the one that we study in the monastery, Chandrakirti's famous work. Don't get him mixed up with Dharmakirti, okay? He studied Dharmakirti last course. I used to get them mixed up all the time, so I can tell you. Chandrakirti is the great Madhyamika scholar, and he designed his book based on the six perfections. His book goes through, follows the six perfections. Why? Because he's talking about the 10 bodhisattva bhumis, okay? The 10 levels that a bodhisattva goes through as he starts to reach enlightenment. And six of those levels, bodhisattva levels, relate to the six perfections. Because at those particular levels, you are gaining an extraordinary ability to practice that perfection. That's why everybody concentrates on the sixth chapter. Because what? I mean, the sixth chapter is 90% of his book.
Thank you.
That's the one about emptiness, okay? But most people don't realize that the Madhyamika scriptures, you know, the first five perfections are there. They're just little tiny chapters at the beginning. But when he reaches chapter 3, perfection number 3, which is what?
Patience.
Not getting angry. The bodhisattva level there is called Rucchepa. Rucchepa means makes light. Light maker. And you can't reach that level until you perfect the ability not to get angry when the time comes that you should get angry. And you know, when the circumstances are such that, you know, somebody's really pushing your buttons and you reach your limit, and then if you don't get angry, then you've just practiced the third perfection. If you get an extraordinary ability to do that, you've reached the third bodhisattva level. Yeah.
Is there some distinction in anger? I mean, you say when somebody...
We're going to talk about it right now. Okay. Classically, this anger should be out of bodhisattva. It should be the one that can get satchipa, the one that can destroy your most basic virtues, should be focused out of bodhisattva.
We should be focused out of bodhisattva.
You should be getting pissed off out of bodhisattva.
What's control again?
That's anger. And these are the two things that can cut your most basic virtues. Okay. This one's presented in the Abhidharma meaning. This one's concentrated on in the Madhyamika scriptures. But these are the two things which can wipe out your whole storehouse of good deeds that you've been working on all this time. You know, you become a Buddhist, you get serious, you really want to be a good person, you start trying, you build it up, and then you get one of these comes into your mind and zoom. It's just a big eraser. It's a big pencil eraser. It wipes it all out. Okay? You go back to square one.
So since you don't know who is a bodhisattva, you may do this on a regular basis.
Beautiful. That's exactly what they say in the scripture. Since we don't know who's a bodhisattva, everyone in this room could be a bodhisattva, for all I know.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. So all the work you've done all these millions of years wiped out?
There's a couple of, what do you call it? I mean, they say...
Extenuating circumstances.
There are extenuating circumstances. I mean, in one scripture, the main scripture says it doesn't matter whether you think you is or not. You know, it doesn't, the identification part doesn't play a very big role here. So, and it doesn't matter whether you have a good reason or not. It says those two things.
It doesn't matter.
Those two things do not much play a role here.
Does it matter how much you express it? Let's say you're feeling angry, but you hold it in.
It's much better if you don't express it.
Oh, okay.
And it's really bad if you have it.
So this would be like...
But if you have it, but you don't...
Much better.
You still wipe out all your karma?
Yeah, I think so.
You might as well punch him and feel good.
Lockdown. It, you know, it's not funny, you know. I don't know. It's a way to lose a lot of ground.
You couldn't apply the same reasoning of the four
They say, by the way, if you want to hear the bad news, ketchik marene akalpa irene. The ratio is instant to kalpa. The ratio is instant to kalpa.
Okay.
Oh, one instant of this anger wipes out a kalpa
When directed at a bodhisattva?
100 countless.
When directed at a bodhisattva or anybody?
Say something more. I don't want to talk anymore about it. It's so depressing.
About the identification part. You said it didn't have to be
clear. They say in the scriptures, and I can show you, that the role of identification, in other words, realizing that he's a bodhisattva, first of all, and secondly, of having some, what do you call it, justification, are irrelevant, mostly, in this case.
So the four karmic paths don't apply here, then?
They do, but what they're saying is the one about the she,
yeah,
the one about the object, is so extraordinary that it outshines the others.
What kind of justification does one have for being angry at a bodhisattva and even at...
Well, let's say that he, you know, as a method, he punches you in the head. That's a better reason than if he was serving you or something. You see what I mean?
Well, what kind of bodhisattva would punch somebody in the head and cause him to go to hell for a long, long time?
I don't know. Maybe he knows something special.
I mean, really?
Well, maybe you're tired or something. You know what I mean? I mean, that's a circumstance. It's kind of a justification.
But it's pushy.
If you're very tired and you get angry at someone, it's a little bit better than if you weren't tired, if you're all fresh and you get angry at somebody. I mean, if you're tired because you were taking care of your kids or something and then you get angry at somebody, that's a little bit of a justification. That's what he's saying.
So then it seems like there's a very large responsibility on the part of bodhisattvas to not get people angry or stir up their emotions?
Shantideva gets into that a lot. He gets into a lot about the responsibility, your responsibility of not setting up circumstances where people around you could collect bad karma towards you. That's true. Shantideva talks a lot about that. I think my boss, Ofa, used to say, don't leave the diamonds around on the table, because somebody with a weaker will than yours will pick it up and steal it. And, you know, to you, it's no temptation to you, but you're not being fair to those other people. You know, you have to put them away nicely, because it's not fair to those other people who might want to take some, you know, like that. Yeah?
Why is it worse to get angry
about we have long stories about that. The extraordinary object principle, right? Someone who just came out of a high state, or he's closer to being someone. It's like breaking the last vial of AIDS antidote in the world, you know. He's rare, he's going to help a lot of people, and here's this last bottle of AIDS medicine in the world, you know. Someone just invented it, and he died, and you got the last bottle, and you just throw it away.
But you're assuming that your anger will affect the bodhisattva, which most likely won't.
No, not that it affects him.
So why would it make a difference to this bodhisattva? This bodhisattva is...
Not the
world, in a way.
Not like that. You can help him. You can help him in his work, or you can hurt him in his work. You can bother Buddhism. You know, Dalai Lama. You can bother him.
But I think Nita's point is that
it's not hurting him.
So why?
Exactly.
And therefore, it can't hurt anyone else. So what difference does it make?
Well,
an impact.
It's such a holy object. You know? Like, I don't know. Jesus walks in the room and you spit on him. That's just different. It's just a different thing. It's just so important.
Michael, this kind of a reverence for this object is not coming from a social culture. You know, when in the olden times, old people were supposed to be respected. How do you know?
No. The point is, he's not special because he's old. He's special because he can help.
No, but I mean, how do you know that this is not because of that?
It doesn't make logical sense. This person is special because he's going to help some old people. Yeah.
Doesn't it also have to do with the conditions that you're setting up in your own mind for your own...
That could be true, too. I mean, it's close to a lotta to get angry at a bodhisattva. It's close to saying, I don't believe in Buddhahood. I don't see why this guy's so special. Just because he's getting close to Buddhahood, who cares? You know, that would be a kind of lotta.
So when they talk about an instant of anger destroying your collection of merit, they're not talking about just getting angry at a normal person.
Well, here. They say by extension you shouldn't get angry. They say that just normal anger also... I mean, if I'm going to be totally honest with you, the scripture says... Should I tell you or not? Bodhisattva to bodhisattva.
Bodhisattva to bodhisattva.
What?
The classic Kong song. Is a bodhisattva getting mad at a bodhisattva. And you can see where that would be really bad. And it's worse for a it's worse to get mad at a higher bodhisattva, and when a lesser bodhisattva gets tired at a higher bodhisattva, then if the higher bodhisattva gets tired, it's a long story. But anyway, then the scripture goes on to say, but it applies to all of us, towards everybody. I mean, strong feelings of anger do have, in everybody, the function of wiping out. And you know, you put up with somebody for a year, and finally you blow up one day. And even in the non-karma world, you've ruined your relationship for maybe years. You know, you just finally crack, and you finally tell them what you feel. And then for a year, you can't get close to them. You know that. All that goodwill that you carefully tended over the months, you know, you just screw up in 1 minute.
Wasn't anger defined as not like your normal old, oh, you chump, you anger, but really hatred?
No. In this case, we're talking about the perfection. And the perfection means really just to get angry at someone else. It also can be anger at an inanimate object. If you stub your toe, or if you curse the traffic, or
when His Holiness was
New York City, or blah, blah, blah.
Curse the traffic?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or cause...
Michael, but the traffic
ignorant.
Was inside.
It's ignorant.
It's ignorant
anger.
No, Michael, but...
No. I'm saying, but it is a kind of control to get angry at the traffic.
Remember when His Holiness was talking about the chapter in Arizona, you know, and he said the translation of anger here really means like a hatred-type anger? Is what he's talking about?
No, I think he was saying... the opposite, you know, it could be things that you call dislike can be controlled. You see, that's what we're trying to say. You can have control all day. It's not that you have to blow up and scream at somebody. It's dysfunctional. There's no function to it. If you understood the emptiness of the traffic, the last thing you'd want to do is get mad about it. It's the same thing as the guy at work. I just didn't want to get into that. Same result.
What gives anger so much more power than virtue?
We'll talk about it. We're going to talk about it today. It doesn't have more power. No, we'll see. There's kinds of... The Buddha cut off 91,000 countless kalpas from his soksak by... he met this Buddha and he jumped around on one leg for a week and praised him. And he cut off 91 countless kalpas. He made his Buddhahood shorter. He got close. He cut off like 100,000 kalpas. 100 countless kalpas. 60, whatever that is. By this great act of faith, he circled him and he swore his devotion to him and cut off a lot of. He shortened his time that he took him to become a Buddha. So there are such things.
I mean,
strong feelings of faith, like when you meet the Dalai Lama and you get this, you know, great, that's the opposite. You just, you know, collected a lot of merit. When you're happy about what he's doing, you feel joy about what he's doing.
I was going to ask you that. So if I go, I'm going to say something really stupid. If I go around the Dalai Lama several times, I'm going
to... Oh, well, I think in our culture, see, that was that culture. But I think in our culture, if you just... worshipped him in an intelligent way. You know, if you just said, look, this person, of all the people in the world, this guy is helping so many. You know, out of all the people in the world, he's being so good, he's so clean, he's so faultless, and he's so, you know, he's so devoted himself to this message that nobody wants to know about anyway. You know what I mean? It's very special that there is such a human being, in the, or a human being or whatever. And that, you know, people realize Nobel Peace, people realize that's special. Anyway, that's lokta and kongcho can destroy your getta. Now, the Abhidharma says, what do they call it? You know, they have a thing in immigration where they figured out the characteristics of a person who's going to be doing
profile.
The profile, yeah. What's the profile of a person who's going to do this lokta? Okay? The Abhidharma gets into it. They say, what's the profile? What are the classic characteristics of a person who's bound to get lokta? Or who can even commit lokta? Okay. And they say, first of all, it has to be a human being. Why? In hell, they can't think a straight thought. They can't get lokta. All they can concentrate, just like when you have a really bad headache, you know? You're not going to philosophize when you've got a bad backache or a bad headache. Hungry spirits, the same thing. They're just running after food. Deities are too happy. Okay. So it's really got to be a human being.
Deities are too happy?
They're enjoying themselves too much.
Don't the demigods war with the gods all the
time? No, sometimes.
Then
they're miserable and they can't do wrong you either. So it's got to be someone who has a firm ability to think. Therefore, they say, eunuchs can't get it either. It has to be, they say when you make a person a eunuch, when a person loses a sexual organ, then he loses some kind of, we would call it estrogen or something, I don't know. But he loses some kind of thing that his mind then becomes very unstable. So anyone whose mind would not be stable, anyone who couldn't hold for a long time a clear rejection of a philosophical viewpoint, you see what I mean? Couldn't collect lokta. So a lokta has to be someone who can think clearly and hold that thought in a firm way. And therefore, they say, if you divide up the people in on this planet, there are two types. The Abhidharma is very interesting. It says there's the kind which are intellectually inclined personalities, and then there's personalities which are more attracted to sensual objects, sensual pleasures. And normally they don't overlap. You know, people are either interested in food or books, or, you know what I mean? There's intellectual types and then there's sensual types. It says it has to be the intellectual type. To get lokta, the person has to be intelligent. They have to be an intellectual.
Why can't they just...
They're the people who will really think it over carefully and firmly get a clearly thought out rejection of the laws of karma.
So just thinking about it a little bit and casually...
Yeah, like, not enough. It has to be a sustained, I should say sustained, it has to be a sustained rejection of this idea that if you do something good, you will get a good result, and if you do something bad, you will get a bad result. It has to be someone who's capable, intellectually, of holding a sustained rejection of that in his mind. And that's the personality profile. So which one of these two was the main one for the Abhidharma? The way to cut your virtue?
Lokta.
The first one, wrong views. Okay, so we're going to talk about, Abhidharma talks about how do you get back on the right track. How do you, they call it, reconnect your virtue root that you cut.
Connect your battery cable.
How do you restore it? And they say there's two ways. One is
getting back what you lost, or just getting back as a right.
Well,
path.
I'll talk about. It's a good question, you know. What happens to the virtue that you have? I mean, is it just wiped out? Is it just erased? What is the process? And all the books say.
It doesn't ripen.
It's not that it ripens later than it was supposed to. It's not that it ripens for a shorter duration, like a lesser pleasure than you thought you were going to have. It says it seriously damages its ability to give a karmic result. Okay. That's the later viewpoint. Abhidharma says, when we say cut your virtue root, we mean you, it's gone, you don't have them anymore.
So which one is true?
We'll say Mahayana. Yeah, it performs some kind of damage on them. So the point is not so much this. If you want to know the sinsam, you know, what do we finally say at the end? It's not so much that it wipes them out or destroys them. It's that it damages their ability to give their proper results. Yeah.
Is the opposite true?
I was just going to get to that. Okay, good question. And this is very, 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 very important. You know, the opposite is true, which is what?
If you hold the correct view that it repairs them?
No, that you could tinker around with your bad karmas. You see what I mean? Wrong view damages. Wrong view throws a monkey wrench into the operation of your good deeds, your good karmas that you've done. And there's something else which throws a monkey wrench into your bad deeds.
and damages their ability to give you trouble. And what is it?
Purification.
Okay.
What do you mean when you say purification?
I mean the four antidotes. And we'll talk about that. I didn't have it in the syllabus, but I'm thinking I better. I think everyone's going to be interested by the last class. So we'll probably do it in the last class, or maybe even in the review. But we'll discuss the four antidotes. We'll discuss purification. But the point is that when the Mahayana scriptures present this concept, they say it goes both ways. You know, they say you can short-circuit your good karma seeds, but you can also short-circuit your bad karma seeds. And whatever's true about one is true about the other. Yeah.
It seems like in no case do you ever completely get rid of them. It just makes them inert.
Well, the Abhidharma, if you read the reading, would say they just go. You lose them.
Right. I'm talking Madhyamika now.
But then the Abhidharma also says that the way they get short-circuited is that over a period of time, they start failing to give their results. So it almost says they're the way it's cut is in some sort of gradual process. It's not that one day, just boom, you know, you lose them. It says they start to peter out, they start to short circuit, they start to not give their proper results over a period of time. You can read it in the Abhidharma.
Yeah. It sounds like that the key here is that there is something which will cause these seeds to come to fruition at some moment in time or not, right?
It's not so much that they say it's a damage to the seed. They say they compare it to two things. Mainly they compare it to fire on a seed. You know, at some point the seed gets scorched and then it starts to lose its ability to give its proper sprout. That's the explanation. Exactly how it works would be interesting. I mean, if we had a longer class, I mean, I'd be curious too. We could use a computer. It's very effective for questions like this. I was using it just in the few minutes before class. I learned a lot. You know, I can skip directly to the references to all these ideas. So, these are the two things. I want to go. We have to take a break pretty soon. Two things that can restore.
Wait a minute.
Two things that can put your good virtues
back. You said Abhidharma. You meant to say Hinayana, right?
Before well, same thing.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
In today's lecture, Hinayana means
Abhidharma. But no, if they're gone, how can you restore?
Abhidharma is a little bit unmerciful. They say, you can read it. First of all, they say that Getache, when you cut them, it means you lose them. They don't exist anymore. You don't have them anymore. But then it talks about a process of reconnecting with them and getting back to them and getting them back. You know, so maybe it means you lose them and then you get them back. I don't know. That's what it says.
That's the same thing as Manatha.
You can read. No, Abhidharmas love to discuss stuff like that. I mean, the Abhidharma scriptures are thousands of pages long. You can do it, Kylie. Okay, Tetsum. Tetsum means what? Doubt. Doubt. Okay? Doubt. There's a good doubt and there's a bad doubt. What do you think the doubt is here?
It's a good one.
Obviously. But what's he thinking to himself? He rejected karma before.
Maybe it wasn't the right thing to do.
Yeah. No, he's getting older in his life. This is very common with Buddhism. I've seen it in a lot of students. They start to get older. They start to, you know, they start to reach the end of their lives. Basically, the pleasures are starting to get less and less. And they start to come back and search again for some answers. And then they're more receptive because they're getting closer to death. Or people who get sick, get serious illnesses, they often get tetsum. They start to doubt their own position. They start to think, well, maybe there is karma. So this tetsum is defined as thinking to yourself, oh, maybe there might be such a thing. And that's enough already to get you back your getta. That's enough to reconnect you with the Buddha. Just going from total rejection to, well, maybe it could be. That's why it's very healthy to keep that, what I mentioned before. Keep that, with the stuff that I say that you can't buy, at least keep this healthy skepticism. Don't reject it outright. Okay, yeah.
Does Lukta only refer to karma? Or is it refer to
It can refer to Buddhahood. Those are classic ones.
That's pretty much it.
There's a lot of lokta. There's no emptiness. Emptiness means nothing. That's a lokta.
This is for Abhidharma?
Yeah, this is Abhidharma way. Okay. So, and it's mainly antidotes for lokta.
Yeah.
What would be the second one?
reversal?
Something even better than tattoo. You know what that would be?
Changing your mind back.
Nyepa means to. Nyepa means, it's a very hard word to translate. Nyepa means to positively identify something. Oh, it is. I don't know a word in English, really. Nyepa, the word means certainty. It's a mental function of certainty. It's like, there is karma.
Affirm?
It's affirm, but affirm in the sense of vaya tema. There is karma. I'm sure of it now. I know it. Nyepa is not only the opinion that you're sure, it's the actual perception that there is.
So it's not fake there. We're talking about...
Not at all. It's a kind of certainty that comes from knowing.
Either intellectual or direct perception.
Yeah. But direct perception comes almost the time for us.
Well, no. The direct perception of emptiness produces such a thing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, a kind of certainty. Oh, there is karma.
If you see the noble truths, you don't necessarily see karma.
That would be enough. That would be enough. Yeah. Yes.
When you say reconnect, do you mean the account was frozen, the money was not drawn?
It's a very good question. It's a very good question. It seems to say that.
Okay.
It seems to say that. And I guess the process is not so much that you destroyed them, but you inactivated them, and now you've reactivated them. I don't want to say that easily, because it's not very clear to me, but I from what I read and from what I understand, that's how it works.
So what is the difference with Mahayana then? It's the same thing, it sounds like. Maybe the war is the difference.
No, same thing, same concept. That's why I'm presenting them together, because I figure you might as well know both of the problems and both the ways to present. We got to take a break. Everybody has to come over there, because we're having a big birthday party.
It's like a hard disk.
I don't know. I never got my data back.
Did you just say that the damaged seeds now are reactivated and bear fruit? Is that what you just
said? I would say that, although it's not very clear. And I admit that it's not very clear. But the wording of reconnect would imply that.
She doesn't want to.
Henjegile. This is another division of karma. If I gave you all the divisions of karma, we'd have a 2-year class about karma. Again, we're just repeating the divisions from sutra, which are reported in the Abhidhamma. Pen is a verb that means to throw or project, and it comes in colloquial speech nowadays with what you do to an arrow when you shoot it. That's called pin. So I don't know what you would call that. Project. They call it projecting karma.
Shooter karma.
Yeah. You can say shooter, but projecting sounds better. Pen jeki le. J means to do, le means karma. So pen jeki le means projecting karma. Projecting what?
The result.
Penjeki Le is the karma which projects your next life. Your whole next life. It's the karma that decides whether you're going to be a human or an animal or a hungry ghost. Or
the very next life?
It's the karma which projects your whole next life. Meaning the whole next life from the time that you're born into your next life. I'm not talking about the bardo. The bardo, by the way, is considered part of your next life in terms... when we're talking about Penjeki Le. So Penjeki Le, projecting karma, is the karma that decides which of the six kinds of births you're going to take. Okay? And then you'll be in that birth for, I don't know, if you're a human, it'll be 67 years. If you're an animal, it might be a few years. If you're in the hells, you'll be a couple million years. But it projects that whole next life. It decides which kind of being you're going to be. And that's what projecting karma means. It's whether you're going to be an animal or whether you're going to be a human, or that's the function of projecting karma.
Is throwing karma accurate?
Throwing's okay, not bad. Sounds a little strange.
These are we have a whole bunch of these karmas already. One of them gets picked or activated.
We'll talk about it. We'll talk about it. Okay. Projecting karma. Yeah.
I was going to sort of ask the same thing.
Since you bring it up,
can it be lightened from one lifetime to another and then become an active?
Yeah, it is. I mean, the big argument in the Abhidharma and the Abhidharma position is that each karma
only one karma can do it tanzikile. It doesn't take many karmas to throw one whole life. It's only one karma that throws the whole life. It's only one of your karmas that you commit in this life which projects your whole next life.
So it's not a special karma, it's just any one random out of the whole batch.
Yeah, depending on the strength. There's a prioritization system, depending on how strong your anger is, how big the object is. You know, the one which is most powerful is going to get pushed up into the queue and project your next life. So this is Abhidharma, Chedatmala, Vaibhashika system. Okay, they say that the whole next life is Pemba, is projected by only one karma. One karma. Because, and their argument is, by the way, this argument is not accepted by anybody else, okay? They say, well, that whole life has one long, what do you call it, consistency to it. You're an animal that whole life, or you're a human that whole life. So therefore, it has to be projected by only one karma. It's not that you change in the next, it's not that you're an animal for 3 weeks and then a human for 4 weeks. So it can't be different karmas. It has to be only one karma which throws the whole life. This is Abhidharma system.
What, I thought it was the state of mind that you're in when you reach the Bardo state that determined it?
Bardo is already too late. The minute your consciousness has left this body, it's already decided, because Bardo is tied to the next birth. In the Bardo already, you look like the being you're going to be born as. Bardo beings have some resemblance. You know, if you're going to go to hell, you look like a charred piece of wood, and there's all these, in the Abhidharma, what Bardos look like, Bardo beings look like. If you could see a Bardo being, you'd know where he was headed. It's one Penjekile, which throws both the Bardo and the next birth. It's the same Penje. The same projected.
But in terms of timing, I was under the impression that, let's say, if you died with extreme fear or extreme anger or extreme mm-hmm. desire, that would propel you. So are you saying you commit this act, let's say, 10 years before you die?
Normally, I think in the presentations of karma, not of the Vaibhashika school, it's sort of the whole effect of your life. You know, what has your life been? If you've been stingy throughout your whole life, it's not just one incident of stinginess. It's a whole lifetime of being stingy and greedy and gluttonous, and then that effect is that you're born as a preta. Only the Vaibhashikas believe in this one, and their argument is a little bit weak. You know, their whole argument is based on. They say it's more or less the effect of your whole life. I mean, you they say many karmas contribute to what you're penjayed into.
So then, really, there's, according to them...
Who? Abhidharma?
Yes. Yeah. There's really nothing that you can do once you're in the Bardo. All the talk about visions and everything else, it's a fatalistic kind of thing.
Well, no, I would say that most schools agree that normally, in the Bardo, you already look like... You already look a certain color, you have a certain color, you walk a certain way, you walk upside down if you're headed a certain way. You know, there's different signs of what you will be. They've already shown themselves at that point.
So did you say that this karma causes you to experience the Bardo in a certain way?
What I'm saying is that the projecting karma, the shooting karma, is not only responsible for you being a certain kind of being for your whole next life, but also for your Bardo. It's one penje, even according to the Abhidharma, it's one projecting karma which releases its power, slow release capsule.
Time release capsule.
From the moment you die until the moment you die in your next life, it's releasing its power all through that whole life. It's one karma which has one consistent quality, and therefore, in the Bardo and also in the next birth, you have this identity. That you are that person from the moment you die in this life all the way to the moment you die in the next life.
And is it the idea that the feeling and thought that you're holding at the moment of death is what you carry?
That's a very powerful influence. Your mind is... I mean, this is accepted by It's mostly described in Mahayana, that at the moment of death, they don't talk about it much in Hinayana, in the Abhidharma. That what a crucial role the moment of death plays. That's mostly although they do say that if you had an extraordinarily strong desire at the moment of death, it would penje, it would throw in that life from you. Yeah. Okay, so what do you think Dzogchen is? It's got something called completing. I call it finishing karma. Like finishing school, finishing a piece of furniture. Why? Dzog, by the way, means finishing or complete. That's like Dzogchen, you know, the great completion or whatever. Dzog means to complete. Dzogchen Kyilei means finishing karma. And it decides the details. And the Abhidharma has a famous line. It says, Penje Kyilei is the master painter who goes to the canvas, the big canvas, and he sketches out the portrait. And then he leaves and goes and does, he's the maestro, you know. And then the students come in and fill in the colors. You know, you can have a lot of apprentices who are not master painters who can do the coloring. So they come in with different colors and paint them. They fill in the colors, and the master has already drawn the whole portrait out. So the job of the apprentices is only to fill in the colors. And that's finishing karma. So according to Abhidharma, can you have one karma do that, or would it take multiple karmas?
One.
Dzogchen, the apprentices who finish the color. Think of each one as being responsible for a different color. Then it would have to be a lot of karmas. So they say the projecting karma is only one, because its result is consistent over your whole next life. But the Dzogchen Kyilei, the finishing karma, that can be many karmas are contributing to that throughout your whole next life. You're rich or poor, you go through these cycles in your next life. You're handsome in your early years, you get ugly in your later years. And the finishing karma is all different. Okay? And different finishing karmas take over at different times.
Both Mahayana system also?
Yeah, pretty much accepted by Mahayana.
The Mahayana agreed with the Penje Kyilei?
They say it's multiple. Except in the case of, say, a Tsamme Kyilei, which we'll study, I think it's next week we have to study that. Those, you know, extraordinary, horrible bad karmas like killing your parents or trying to hurt a Buddha. It's one incident because of which you take your whole next life in hell. And that's, I think in that case, a Mahayana would say, oh yeah, that's one karma that creates the whole next life.
How does the Mahayana distinguish between
Penje Kyilei? Same. They accept it. It's just a question is, can this be multiple or not? And Mahayana says, of course it can be multiple. You see it all over scriptures.
No, but if they're both multiple, what distinguishes between throwing and finishing?
Oh, no, same distinction. Only the Abhidharma school says, Penje Kyilei has to be one single event of your life. Okay.
If they're both multiple, how are they different?
From each other.
One is more powerful. Penje Kyilei is more powerful. That's the mugyu. That's the main cause. You know, that's just more powerful. And it's more powerful. It's done with greater anger. It's done towards a more holy object. You know, it's basically a distinction of power. That it's powerful enough to decide which realm you're born into. And then the finishing karma is the smaller incidents of this life which determine what kind of money you're gonna have. Or so we call mushi. Mushi means I'll talk about one. You missed the last course, right?
Okay.
We did a whole course on it. You guys know.
Okay.
By the way, I wanted to say, what did that remind me of? Oh, there's a certain stage at which, by the way, you can't cut your virtues. It's impossible. And that's at a certain point in the second of the five paths. Which kind of relates to your question. Your question reminded me of that. What are the five paths?
Renunciation.
which is called preparation. I'm sorry, collection, accumulation.
Preparation. Pathosis.
Seeing.
Habituation.
No more
learning.
And no more learning. So you don't have to know them for this course, but basically, that's an outline of your spiritual career. The first path is reached when you reach true renunciation, when you're really sick of lying. Second path is reached when you get intellectual understandings of emptiness. The third path is reached when you see emptiness directly for the first time. The fourth path is the whole process of removing your bad thoughts based on your understanding of emptiness. And then the fifth path is not really a path, it's just a state of having finished them all. So, and the second path, which is what? What are you doing on the second path? No. Dharma. What's happening on the second path?
That
was down. Yeah. You're getting clearer and clearer intellectual understandings of emptiness. And because of that, at a certain point, you can no longer do Geta Chepa. Impossible. You will never lose your most basic virtue.
At a certain point in the path number two, not at the beginning.
Yeah, in path number two, right. Because you understand emptiness.
And then at path number three, you can't create any more non-virtues.
You're not collecting any more Dunga Dhamma. You're not collecting any more Kumbhina. You're not collecting any more source of suffering. So, that's a nice, if you can reach that point, it's called Semo. It's called peak. It's not the highest level, but it's called peak anyway. The peak level of the second path, once you reach that, you can no longer destroy your good deed out of lobha. And out of anger also, actually.
So a person who just becomes an Arya,
he can't destroy.
They don't get angry anymore, or they have this different kind of anger where it looks like the old, but it doesn't have the same old gusto to it, or something. And
I believe you could say what you're asking me, and now I'll throw the question back to you. You know, if I was in a debate ground, I'd do that. Is anger one of the emotions eliminated permanently by the path of sleep? Is it one of the bad?
I don't know, but according to you, if there is any bad karma that comes from it, that would be no longer accumulated.
How many did I give you?
How many what?
Angers?
How many? What two bad thoughts do you remove permanently when you see emptiness directly? There's only two.
Belief.
Kind of wimpy.
Self-existence.
The belief in what you see. You know. You still see it, but you don't believe it anymore. And then what's the other one? No, doubt. Okay. You cannot doubt Buddhism ever again. Because you saw Buddha. And I mean, you know, not to brag, but at that moment, you realize Buddhism is the correct religion of the world, you know. Seriously. I mean, I wouldn't say that in a public lecture, okay? But it is totally correct. It works. It's true. If you follow it, you can get there. You won't suffer anymore. There is such a thing as a Buddha. You will be that. It'll take so many lives. You will live them this way. You see all this. Period. You see it.
So none of the Christian saints ever saw emptiness because they didn't talk about Buddhism when they came out. Or
if you call it Buddhism, but I don't know.
Well, I call it not number three because in number three, then you really know it, not just intellectual.
Apparently, it's enough to have an intellectual understanding not to ever get this sustained wrong view again. Okay. I just wanted you to know that. Okay, now, your question was first. Oh! The Book of the Dead, first of all, according to serious Buddhist scholars, is defective. That book is defective. There are similar books which are not defective. That one happens to be defective, according to tradition, according to Tibetan Buddhist tradition, actually. You know, the details are something incorrect. It's very good if you can perceive emptiness at death. It's the last thing you'll be able to do as you experience that extraordinary suffering, the final suffering, the worst suffering of your life, worst day of your life, worst 5 minutes of the worst day of your life. You're into a situation of hallucinations. It's as if someone injected a bottle of Jack Daniels into you. And you have no more ability to think about emptiness unless you've spent your whole life preparing, which is the whole idea.
But only what you've done consistently over your whole life will take over at that moment. Because you can't, you're in terrible pain. And beyond that, because of the physical breakdown of your cells and your nerves, you can't sustain a clear thought. The basis for the clear thought is being removed, so it's hard, it's very difficult, it's very unlikely, almost impossible. You can. It's a great goal, and there's a big meaning. We will someday cover that subject, I hope, if we all live to that long. But there are, you can learn all that. You can learn it properly. And there is a proper text for that. And, we'll do it someday.
So the idea of attaining enlightenment, the options are this life.
To wait to the last minute is you know it's bad in any endeavor, right?
Yeah.
It's unlikely. It's just a bad time to pick. I mean, if you want to do it tonight. Excuse me.
I was just saying, of all the options then for attaining enlightenment, the ones that are normally mentioned as like the ones to really utilize.
It is a very important moment. It's an extremely important moment. It is the most opportune moment from the point of view of possibilities.
But you said it's very unlikely.
But it's just to for the mind to do it at that moment is extremely difficult. Much better to do a good retreat here and just finish it now.
The same with the bardo, the idea of...
No, as you move into the bardo, it's very difficult. Once you're in the bardo, it's even worse. According to the scriptures that we study, which are ancient, those are the real, and if we ever get to that point, we'll do it. Yeah.
Did you say according to Abhidhamma, the Panchakile is...
Has to be only one.
Resulting from one...
Incident of your life.
One incident.
Yeah.
And Mahayana says it's many.
Yeah, they say, come on, scriptures always, But they say, why do they say that? Because the result is one consistent stream. Therefore, it can't be a hodgepodge of causes because the result is only one. And the other schools say come. Okay, we can finish on time, I believe that. Give me the mushi. Mushi musu means when a kid in the monastery doesn't have anything to bait, he says, mushi musu shakri mayesu. It means, you can't show me the four permutations of these two.
Can you?
I mean, when you're a kid in the monastery, you can't think of anything to minimize it. Mushi musu mayesu. And that buys time, because it takes time to go through the permutations, and in the meantime, you might think of something serious. So, think of, I'll say good and bad. And I'm going to ask if you can guess, and then I'll tell you the classical. So, Fran, I'll give you the first one. The first move would be not a cow, okay? Tell me a kind of rebirth, which is a good penjekile, but a bad zochekile.
Oh, this is throwing in.
It's okay, a good, the penje is good.
A human is good.
Yeah, by the way, anything above a human is good. I mean, there's three good births and three bad births, basically. Human, what they call demigod and god are good. And then hell, animal, and preta are bad. The penje, to be born into one of those three higher ones, and especially as a human, is good. And if the dzogche was bad, that's your job. You got to give us
sick?
A good penje and a bad dzogche.
He's sick?
He's always sick. Yeah, exactly. He has a lot of suffering in this life. So as far as what realm he got to, the Shudakarma was great. He got to be a human, but he's sick all the time. That's a good penje and a lousy dzogche. So, Vilma, you got to give me now, I've really bought some time, a bad penje and a good dzogche.
A bad would be an animal that lived at the temple.
Yeah, I mean, Rinpoche is always saying that about his dogs, because he makes them sit in class and they get all this, they got all these seeds in their mind from the pain. Yeah. The penje is lower, it's the birth of misery. It's one of the lower three realms.
But the Dzogchen is good. The classical references in scripture are Shinje She. Shinje She means the Lord of Death. And it's not Yamantaka or something like that. This is a real... remember the guy who stands at the pearly gates and, you know... This is the one who stands at the doors of hell. Supposedly there is such a being. And he's actually... There's a debate whether he's a hell being or a preta. But he's got this terrible rebirth. But he's the master of hell. He is the lord of hell. And he decides what happens in hell. You know, he's like the big boss in hell. So it's a lousy penje for him. But he gets to be the number one hell guard. You know, he's the number... So that's the one classical example. The other is the Nagas. Okay, suppose, according to Buddhism, there are these class of beings that we cannot see that have some kind of snake-like qualities, except they are very intelligent. And they have great wealth also. So they are reborn as a kind of like an animal. But they can think, they can talk, they have great jewels that they can... that they have in their lands and things like that. We can't see them. Nagarjuna went there, he did negotiations with them, brought back scriptures, stuff like that. That's why he was called Nagarjuna.
You talk about, you mentioned earlier about the wanting to be reborn in a paradise, a Buddhist paradise. Is that the same as a formless realm?
No, not at all. And Pabonka and other lamas are always saying, you know, please don't make the boo-boo, you know. What is a temporary form and formless realm? It's a temporary nice state,
yeah,
which the flow chart normally goes back to hell.
Yeah.
And in Buddhist paradise, you know, Dakpe Shinkam, you know, Buddha field, is totally different. You're outside of suffering.
I thought Buddha is
outside of the realms. He's standing outside. He's up in the right hand corner.
That's the Buddha, but I thought unless you're a Buddha, you're in one of those six realms.
That's right.
No, not on our heart.
Really?
No.
Well, the only person who could go to a Buddha field is a Mahayana Aryan.
Long story. Abhidharma describes how you can go visit certain places. If you are in the company of another person.
So what are the options? So you get the six realms.
Be born
what are the other options to be born? What are the other options where you can be born other than the six realms of soul?
No, there's only six realms.
Plus the Buddha field, plus anything else like that.
Oh, we don't call it a birth. Leidan Yomogi Wongkyor. To be born through the power, to be forced to be born there. To be forced there by karma and your bad thoughts. That's samsaric birth. They take birth, but they're not forced into it.
Are there any other realms like that Buddha field?
Nothing, no.
But in the God realm, there's a form and formless. Is that correct?
Well, the God realms go through... They start at the top of the desire realm, and they spread to the form and formless realm. If you're in the form and formless realm, you're a God. And at the top of the desire realm, you can be a God. But those what you call God is not a... As I said, there's two kinds of thoughts. One is a worldly thought. He is suffering. And then there's a, you know, a tantric law or a Buddha law. That's a big... These are totally different things. What is I call them pleasure beings and angels.
And on the wheel of life, it's divided into... Should I shut up?
Yeah, I better. Okay. People stun. Okay. But we'll do it after class if you want. Okay. Who's going to give me number three? Who else?
What's number three?
Good and good.
Born as a human and you encounter the Dharma and become enlightened.
Yeah, that sounds good. And Carolyn, bad and bad.
Born as a dog, was cheated or was in a garbage dump.
Yeah, I like that. The classic example is Avicii Hell. Avicii Hell means Narme. The lowest hell of all. The name of it is no suffering, no torment. And what it means is torment with no stopping. It's a misnomer. Okay. And that would be a bad projected karma and a bad continuing karma. Okay. Pretty much.
So the guy in the gate of that place, right?
Yeah.
Who's the chief honcho runs the concentration camp, as it were.
Yeah.
I mean, how could you go lower than that? I mean, is he going to end up going to the bottom of the very hell that he runs because of all the things he did there?
Yeah, actually, I think normally he does. I think normally that takes him...
But that seems to be the way things work. You know?
And that, by the way, according to Buddhist philosophy, is an office that each of us has held many, many times.
Actually,
right?
They're not talking about purification.
Not tonight. But I, you know, I'm beginning to think I better shove it into the syllabus. We'll do it. We'll definitely do it. Maybe the review card. Okay. Mr. Kiley. I did pretty good. It's 9:04. Come on. We didn't even turn the clock back.
On the Wheel of Life, you know, they have the white and black painted in. And the three, you know, animal, craving spirit, and hell realms are in the white. And then the humans are in the black.
I'm sorry, I'm backwards.
The humans are in the white, but you described the humans as not being able to generate white karma, but it's not painted that way.
Well, white in the sense, it's very technical sense of this narrow sense. But
good
white
is general.
Thank you.
What is, you know, being is born for a thousand years in hell versus, 10 years as a dog. What leads to the one versus the other? I mean, why such a disparity?
The power of the karma. And I, you know, what we never, we're probably not going to get into is the four Mahayana rules. You know, it blows up. It increases exponentially.
Right.
Yeah, we're going to
So, in the idea of Madhyamika Prasangika, you know, how our perception creates our future karma, our reality, okay? It's not clear to me the distinction between our perception creating it versus our good deeds creating it.
That's an idea that the perception of your deed planting a bhakti, and then the bhakti flowering into the perception of the karma.
So it's not the deed itself, it's the perception of the deed that's important.
Mainly.
So if you stab somebody, yeah, you think, I'm helping this person.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. But it doesn't make it. It's not totally dependent on
that. That's what I don't understand, how that actual deed turns into a karmic result, since the entire perception is oriented towards I'm doing goodness, you see.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's difficult. There is some... It's not just your opinion of yourself.
There's some objective reality out there of some kind.
I don't want to say that.
Well, you're not self-existent, no.
There is some essence of a deity that hurts others that makes it bad.
Yeah, I didn't understand how a box shock actually creates a perception, you know, in the Madhyamika Prasangika.
You mean how it flowers?
Yeah. Well, no, you actually do a deed, right? You know, it comes to a conclusion. You know, you plant a bhakshak, and, you know, like, I just help somebody, I plant this bhakshak of doing good. You know, how does that...
How does it... I don't see any... No, I know what you mean, but I don't see any deeper than that in scripture. You know?
Yeah.
It doesn't get that far...
Okay.
I the content part, you know, that somebody in the other class said, well, why should the content part be the opposite? You know, you're doing a bad deed. To out to someone else. Shouldn't the result be out to someone else rather than back? I don't know.
You know, it's almost like by definition, you know, like at the most basic level of definition, when we define karma, we saying, you know, a good deed is something which brings pleasure. You know. I mean, you can almost say, like, a bad deed is something which brings pleasure, and substitute that throughout all the logical reasonings, and all the logical reasonings would still hold. Look, if you change your base definition, right? Mm-hmm. Your base definition is helping someone brings pleasure, okay? Mm-hmm. And then everything else, all the other logic, inserts
that. No,
that.
I didn't say that.
Huh?
I said a good karma is something that brings pleasure.
Right.
What do you mean? Can I get it for you? What's going on?
I'm
going to
see this water.
I thought you were going to leave it out for the mouse.
Mouth
wants to dig into dirt. Mm-hmm. See, I tie him up so he doesn't bother Rusty.
Well, Rusty comes around.
I'm pleased with
him. Yeah. He has some kind of compassion. He can't stand to see him in front of
That's true.
What I was saying was the idea of good karma is something which brings you pleasure.
No. The definition of good karma is something. Anything that brings you pleasure is good karma.
Right. And then we go on to say, what is that? Is benefiting others.
They don't say that much.
That's what the whole lot rhymes about, isn't it?
Well, what if you just leave it like that?
I know.
A karmic result from it. Good,
well, that's the thing for me, because I mean, I the base definition is faultless, you know. I mean, it's, you know, a good karma brings you pleasure, but then the whole
anything that brings you pleasure is good karma.
Okay. Karmic. Yeah. Okay. So anything that brings you pleasure is good karma. And then the whole long room goes on to say.
You want me to lock it up?
Yes, you want.
It's not. Let me go lock up.
Okay.
If I don't do it, I'll forget.
Okay.
You see, when you do something at work and it works, it's not necessarily anything to do with what you did. Mm-hmm. When something changes, it could just be the good karma of having tried to help the person, rather than any outside mechanism actually working the way we normally do.
Can it have an influence that rapidly, by the way?
Yeah.
Like, oh, it can have it almost immediate.
Yeah. But it often doesn't, and that's why it doesn't always work, and that's why people get frustrated. With dogs, it's still pee.
Can you, since you're on this, can you clarify something? Because I tried, I read the last few pages of the reading for this class, and or last week's class, and I still couldn't quite grasp the relationship between a being's perception of an object and the functioning of the object and how those two are connected to each other.
The point is that because they're empty, that gives them room to be functional. And most people think the opposite. They think if they were empty, they couldn't function. But the truth is that because they're empty, it makes room for them to be functional.
The question that was asked about, you know, is blood and pus real for a craving spirit?
Is it actual, or why not?
And my answer was, it is for that craving spirit because it functions to hurt them. But I didn't quite understand that answer.
Well, what's the test of something is real? If it can affect you. If it can produce an effect in you.
So then the only measure of reality is whether or not it functions in relation to an individual's perception.
Not exactly. I mean, the ultimate test of reality is, can you perceive it with a permanent? An additional confirmation would be, can it affect anything? Mm-hmm. But not all existing things affect anything. So really the main test is whether or not you can see it with a permanent.
But
you're not to be drunk, not to be crazy. You can see it. And it exists. Actually, in that case, it's also functioning to produce a perception. But anyway, when it starts to affect you, then it has some reality. Those are the two arguments for why it's actual plus and blood. A, he can see it and he's not crazy. And then B, it affects him.
And whether or not that's valid for any other being,
well,
is irrelevant? Oh dear.
I got it.
No.
Maybe it'd be nice if people stop feeding the dogs cookies.
Oh yeah.
So when in the Madhyamika Prasangika view, when people say, you know, this is my past karma, like, oh, I've got this past karma that caused this to happen to me, really, who they are at that moment in time is their past karma. Would that be correct?
Well, the Abhidharma says something pretty close to that. They say, I mean, Abhidharma view is that the person is the flow of his karma.
Right.
That's a pretty sophisticated view.
Is the flow? Could you say that again?
Yeah. There's this whole thing about the person being the flow of his karma.
Uh-huh.
the past has led them to who they are now, which will lead them to who they are in the future. So all the past karma is who they are now.
But it's probably also that momentary.
It's changing.
It's not first.
Just not static.
It's not first. Give it a sniff. See what it is. I suspect it's water for the plants.
I think so. Gotta go.
Yeah. I
should just
make sure you don't. Would you mind if I ask you one more quick question?
I don't mind. The idea of,
because my other jobs are waiting for me.
The idea of when karma ripens, you know? There's this idea of you've got all these bok chaks floating around, you know, and all this stuff is coming together and arising, and we're perceiving it a certain way. Mm-hmm. What determines when a karma ripens? Is it that, like, by us consciously doing things, we lay some kind of foundation that creates the circumstances and the causes and conditions for the events to come together and have them happen?
I'm not too clear on it, but tonight I read some stuff that said it's pretty much, they talked about this QE. In computers, they call it queuing, you know?
Yeah.
Who goes up in front of the queue?
Yeah.
And they said it's determined by, the power of the deed, the power of the object. Some deeds are so powerful they can bump other deeds down.
Isn't there also a kind of synergy between them?
How do you mean?
Well, in the sense that, say you have a preponderance of karma that came from killing, that's more likely to appear and, you know, or manifest as killing behavior.
That one kind of karma. But he's talking about the timing.
The timing. Why is it right then now versus later? You know, it's, for example, if I really focus my mind on working on my issues around
killing.
Could I bring my consciousness to
right
at this moment so I could deal with them? Or can I, by virtue of me working on who I am and the nature of the functioning of my mind and perceptions, will all of those karmic seeds come to fruition and ripen now? Or some of them are...
Wasn't that what they say happens when you do purification? Suddenly all these obstacles start arising.
Yeah, yeah. They say that. I mean, in my head.
So in terms of the timing of the ripening of the karma...
You can affect it.
Wait, could we really have one? Could we have one additional session in which students could bring the questions that came out of the room?
I used to do that, and you know what's even better about it is I used to get the really thorny ones and go ask big lamas to speak into it.
This is the end of Class 8.